Welcome back to my series on morality. My name is Father Cody, and we are in session 8. Probably the one that's going to make the most people squirm, and the one I'm kind of most excited for. Sexual ethics. The reason why I'm excited for this session is not because I want to talk about sex, but because I want to express the Church's view on sex and sexuality. Most people assume that Christians see it in a very negative light, as something disgusting or vile. That is not true. It is something rather beautiful. But before we get there, let me take you on a journey through the wide world of sexual ethics and the way that humanity has dealt with it for centuries. Because every society has wrestled with this question: what is the proper use of our sexual faculties? Who can I have sex with and why? What are the boundaries around sex? And what is considered normative within the sexual union? All these questions are common throughout every society. For example, going back to ancient Rome was a very sexualized culture. They had statues that depicted what we call pornographic imagery. It was for them, at least. They would have lots of orgies as part of their parties. A lot of their worship of the deities was centered around sexuality. It was actually so common that the plant they used as a contraceptive is completely extinct. It went extinct after the Roman Empire, and we've never found it since. If we go around the world, things get even weirder. Where there's various cultures within Africa, some of them claim that to be a man, you have to be circumcised with a blunt rock when you're 14 years old. If the boy cries out, screams, or anyway winces in pain during it, he has to wait for it to heal and try again a year later. And he's not considered a man until he's finally circumcised. There's another African culture where, in order for a woman to become a woman, she has to have sex with the elder. This has caused a lot of STDs, by the way. But nevertheless, this idea of sex and sexuality has been the topic of so many discussions in so many different cultures. What is considered normative? What relationships are part of this? But before we go further, I need to talk about sex itself. Sex is deeply rooted in the nature of the human person, so much so that St. John Paul II wrote an entire huge volume on the issues of the body and the beauty of sexuality in his masterwork, The Theology of the Body. He makes points very clear to us, things we often forget. Sex is rooted in who we are. It's something about how we present ourselves. It's how we relate. It's who we are as human beings. All that is related to sexuality. So in a way, the first starting point, sex has to be understood biologically. Why? That's where it starts. You can't have sex without some sort of biology. To be very blunt and kind of graphic, you need a penis and a vagina, or the ends of sex are not met. So in that way, we have to understand the biological side of sex. There is an innate desire within us to spread our seed, to start the next generation, to give of ourselves in such a way that we form offspring. In the Church's language, the man gives himself, and in so doing makes the woman a mother. The mother giving of herself gives the child back to the father and makes him a father. There's this giving and receiving in the reciprocity of sexuality that's rooted in our biology and expressed in the emotional, social side of it. But even deeper than that, many studies today have shown that sex is biological. When someone has sex with another, they're not just doing some fun activity. They're not just engaging in recreation. They are biochemically bonded. There is a special biochemical relationship that forms between that man and that woman that carries into their psyche. When the relationship breaks apart, it actually causes emotional and chemical damage. Sex is a big deal. It is so much a part of who we are that we have to remember that. It is part of who we are. It changes who we are. It helps us become who we are. That's the biological side. But there's more than just biology. It's not just the sharing of semen or the biological side of sex. There's also a social side. The social side can be seen more in social norms. But the social side is also related to emotional. Who am I giving myself to? Who am I allowing to enter into my body? Who am I choosing to unveil myself before and so give myself in that way? In the social side, we also put boundaries around it. We talk about rape, we talk about incest, we talk about fornication, we talk about proper uses of sex. All these things are related to social boundaries. Establishing from the beginning, who is my mate? Who am I bounded to for life? Who do I give myself to? All that is part of the social side of sex. As we get deeper into the emotional, mental side of that social aspect, we also recall the damaging sides and the benefits of sex. It's an endorphin rush. It makes people feel good. It makes them feel connected. It makes them feel like they are loved and cared for when it's in proper context. On the flip side of that, sex can also make people feel degraded. They can feel violated. They can feel broken or miserable. And this happens largely when people are violated through it or have had sex with so many different partners that they lose that sense of self. Years ago, a friend encouraged me to watch this movie with him, and during the trailers for the movie, there was a trailer that just broke my heart. I forget the name of the movie, but I've never forgotten the images. There's this woman who at a very young age started having sex more often with men, and then became a prostitute, and after a horrible life as a prostitute, this guy came to interview her, and as she's telling her story to him, he asked her, "Why'd you do it?" And she said, "Because I wanted to be loved." When we break the relationship aspect of sex, when we make it so mundane that it becomes recreative, we forget what we are seeking. Sex teaches us how to love and how to love fully, what it means to be loved and to love in response. Without that side, we have so damaged ourselves, both on an emotional, physical, psychological level, that we lose some of who we are. So that's the biological and the social side. There's also another side that we often forget about. That's the spiritual side. There is a spiritual side to sex. It's rooted in the nature of God. God, being so loving and so giving, gives himself entirely, and by giving himself entirely, makes the Son who he is. The Son giving himself entirely to the Father spirates the Holy Spirit. In that gift and receiving relationship in the very triune nature of God is the core of sexuality, giving and receiving. So in that way, sex takes on a spiritual level. It's spiritual in that we merge with the divine. It's life-giving, life-forming. In that way, sex is the greatest gift we have in that way, in that it gives life. The only thing we can do that truly gives life. I emphasize this because we have to see the good of sex. It's a beautiful, wonderful thing that in its proper context can be nourishing to relationships, can give people a sense of well-being, can give them a sense of support, can give people a sense of connectedness, and breathe life. This is sex. So now, when sex breaks down, which is why we have sexual ethics. The first topic in this is contraception. Most people see contraception as a good thing, and for that reason, I want to talk about society's perspective and how they understand contraceptive use. The main argument for contraceptive use is the ability to plan one's family, which is a moral good. People shouldn't have to have endless numbers of children, or as the Simpsons made so bold as a claim against the Catholic Church, plop till you drop. That kind of boldness is what some people feel, that without contraceptive use, women are just supposed to keep having children endlessly until they either die from the pregnancy or die from the abuse of children. That is not true. Although it is good to plan one's family, contraceptives are not the only way. And so in that way, most people see contraceptives as a way to have sex without having children, which is not entirely true. Let me go through the various uses of contraceptives and how misleading they can be. The most common form of contraceptive use is the condom. Well, that's not true. The pill is probably the most common. The condom is a membrane that goes over the penis to prevent sperm from entering the vagina. Okay, cool. Most condoms claim that they are 99% effective. That is, They are 99% effective if worn on the right size, they don't break, and the person uses it correctly. If they break or any of those issues happen, the actual effectiveness of a condom, given all the things that could happen, is closer to 65%. Yeah, not as great as we hoped. The pill, very much so related, is a oral form of contraceptive that women take that prevent the egg from ovulating. Egg doesn't come. It is considered to be 99% effective, but it has a lot of health effects. By messing with hormones, you mess with the mentality of the person, you mess with their thoughts, you mess with their biology. When contraceptives, the pill, was originally developed, it was tested on people in Africa. 30% of them died from the testing. Messing with hormones is a big deal. I don't want to underemphasize that point. Although we like to think of the pill as this miracle thing, what the pill and condoms collectively are doing is allowing people to have sex without consequences, so they can do it whatever they want and become recreative. It loses all those beautiful elements that I mentioned before. That is the challenge with contraceptive use, that it doesn't allow people to express themselves most fully and allows them to become recreative. There are other forms of contraceptives. So there's various things that women can put within the vagina, such as the UV ring, that are physical things put in there to prevent sperm from entering the body. They have serious health effects, including bleeding, damage to the uterus and vagina. They're super uncomfortable in many cases. Yeah, there's lots of health effects from these things. The most new of the forms of contraceptive is one that's just in the testing phases. It's a male oral contraceptive. Man takes it and it causes his sperm to become immobile. They can't move. And eventually reduces the amount of sperm. Here's the issue. Most men are not as concerned with contraceptive use as women. A man who forgets to take his medicine, it's not as big of a deal to him, but a woman who does so means she could get pregnant. So largely, male contraceptives are not nearly as commonly used as female forms because men are just as concerned about it. And that's a serious social issue that needs to be addressed. That if we're going to keep proposing these things, we need to see how to do it well. That being said, this is the Catholic Church's perspective on contraceptives. Contraceptives break the two ends of sex, procreative and unitive. Unitive we are most familiar with, that is the two coming together to express their love through sexual union. Procreative means the formation of children. That is what sex is for. Regardless of whether we want to talk around it or change the language or whatnot, that is what sex does. The consequence of sex is children. Therefore, what contraceptives do is it breaks those two ends. It makes it either merely unitive or simply unitive, getting rid of the whole procreative element. We don't want to have children. We do what we can to prevent that. I like to think of contraceptive use as unitive, that they are trying their best to form a union and show their love for each other without the consequence of children. What I've been reading in more and more articles is that that's not honestly the case. More than often, what contraceptives use allow is that one partner can choose to have sex when the other one doesn't, which is also a form of rape if we're not careful. So instead of just seeing it in unitive, it's now becoming more of a way to allow your partner to do what he or she wants without the consequences. And that's kind of sad. The other side of it, which we don't always talk about, and I want to bring it up now because it helps you understand the rest of the perspective, is that there is a way in which women can choose when to have children and yet not use contraceptives. Most people kibosh this idea, but it's natural family planning. The basic underlying idea is, if God wants us to be perpetually fertile, he would have done so. Then this whole conversation would have been very different. But instead, there are periods within a woman's normal cycle where she is fertile and infertile. So having sex during the infertile time periods is just as effective at preventing children as any form of contraceptive. During the fertile period, you're very likely to have children. So, by recognizing the ebbs and flows of a woman's cycle, the partners can decide when to have sex, when is appropriate, and whether they want children or not, without any use of any outside means. What this does, on a social level, is it makes the couple talk about issues of sexuality, makes them real about when they feel like it and when they don't, and makes them choose when to come together and actually dialogue about that. This kind of conversation is great in building proper relationships and full, healthy relationships. We forget how important it is to dialogue about sex and sexuality. These are important for good, healthy marriages. Some people argue that isn't natural family planning the same thing as contraceptive use? Well, contraceptive use is using something artificial to declare, no, I'm not having children. The natural family planning always has underlying it the openness to children. It reminds us that sex leads to children. It reminds us that we have to be real about that fact. We're not closing ourselves off to it, but we're also not necessarily fully open to having a child now. It leaves those possibilities open, and it leaves the possibility for dialogue, where contraceptives don't necessarily have to. It can just be, did you put that on or not? Did you take the pill or not? So I'm a big fan of natural family planning as a way of allowing people to have dialogue about it, being able to be open about what's going on, and using the natural systems of the body to help enrich marriages. The next one. The most hot-button topic issue related to this that I can bring up, which is abortion. What I want to do as we talk about abortion is talk about both sides of the debate and what's going on. It'll help us understand in a greater context why this is such a problem and why it's become such a social issue. So let's start with the social society's perspective. The basic slogan is pro-choice. Now, obviously, if we chose the opposite side of anti-life, that sounds horrible. So, clearly, pro-choice is a better option. But pro-choice does emphasize the point that they're trying to make. Women should have the right to choose what happens to their body. I don't think many people would argue against that. From a very simple perspective, of course, we have the choice of what to do with our bodies. We have the choice of how to treat it. But that being said, there are limits to that. We don't just have free rein to do whatever. If I choose to cut off my arm and said, I want society to pay for reattaching my arm because I want to cut it off, that doesn't work. That would be an abuse of the idea of choice. The same way, we should always be choosing for what's good for our bodies. What makes me healthy? What makes me do well? What makes me feel like life is worth living? That's the big question. So underlying the idea of pro-choice is this idea that we do have rights over our bodies, and we should have the right to choose what happens to them. Let's flip the side. So we're going to go with the pro-life side. See, if we use the other language, it'd be anti-choice, which seems stupid, especially in American context. So, pro-life. The pro-life stance states various things. First of all, that the developing fetus is a human being, and that human being has rights. It has abilities. It also has free choice of what happens to its body. And so in that way, the pro-life movement emphasizes the fact that all life is sacred, all life is important, and we should cherish and honor all forms of life. Here's the divide. We already know it. What do we do about it? So the divide is, should women have to go through their entire pregnancy just because they're pregnant, or is there another way through which a woman doesn't have to go to full term? Well, let's step back a ways. This is way too simplistic to really recognize what's going on socially. So what's happening socially? Socially speaking, we are a very overly sexualized culture. We value sex well beyond what it should be. Its context is to solidify a relationship, to prove that someone loves us, to make a clear statement about whether we love someone, or just because it's fun. In that context, we should expect a high level of pregnancies. We are so overly sexualized that we only want the joy of sex without the consequences. So, what does that mean for our ethical decisions from there? Well, I don't want the consequence, so I'm going to get rid of it. In what other element of society do we think the same way? If I was in a job and I said I don't want to clean the floor, I'd be fired. If I didn't want to do my work in school, I'd get an F. There are consequences. That being said, most people consider me cruel for saying so in the context of abortion. Because you had sex, the consequence is you have a child. Well, that poor child is going to be killed because of consequences as well. What ought we to do? Pope Paul VI made some chilling declarations in his groundbreaking encyclical Humanae Vitae on human life, in which he states that people or societies who devalue life and don't see it as important will ultimately fall apart. Because, as I mentioned in the last one on medical ethics, if we devalue people's life for genetic disorders, or because we don't find them productive, or because we just don't like what they provide for society, then we ultimately say life is not valuable. It's only valuable in as much as we put the boundaries around what we want life to be. And that's the challenge. If we support abortion, we go on that same route of genocide or that same route of devaluing life to the point where we can kill anyone. But if we stand firm on the idea of life as valuable and sacred, then we find new means and new ways through which we can support the good of life and continue to provide for the good of people, including the ability for people to choose rightly what happens to their body within certain reasons. There are certain boundaries around that one too. So ultimately, what we have to understand is the fetus that is developing in the woman's womb is a human being. It genetically has all the elements of a human. It will develop into a human, and therefore it should have the rights of a human. How do we balance out the issues of the rights of an individual to the rights of the baby? What does that look like? That is where we need to talk and dialogue and find reasonable solutions to help end or settle this debate. The next one I don't find very exciting. We know what it is, we understand what it is, but I want to describe it in greater detail because this is the greatest problem in marriages, and that's fornication or adultery. Fornication and adultery are all based out of two basic concepts. Either I don't want to commit to someone, but I want to show my love, or I don't want to be committed anymore, and therefore I'm looking for a way out. Adultery. Both of these situations show the challenges we have today. We are so challenged with the idea of building a relationship. Relationships are built on trust. They have their down points and their good points. And if we don't recognize and support marriages and support relationships, then ultimately these issues will continue to be a problem. What fornication and adultery do is they put boundaries around the sexual relationship and around marriages. They teach us what is right and proper. They make us fight for the good of the spouse, and they make us realize that relationships are tough. There are times in which we just have to fight through the challenges and see what we can do. That being said, contraceptive use is very much so directly related to fornication and adultery. If I can have sex with another person and there's no consequences, then what's to stop me from doing it again? The next topic is sexually explicit content in media, aka pornography. I bring this up because it is one of the biggest social issues of our time. Most kids will get involved with pornography by the age of 8, and most will be more or less addicted by the age of 14. Most people who are trafficked for pornography-related stuff are trafficked in their early years between 8 and 12, and if they are kept in the sex slave market, will usually die by the age of 25. Pornography is such a major issue that it is the largest industry in America right now, grossing about $50 billion a year. And it is also one of the greatest ways of degrading men, women, and children. Pornhub was recently sued just a few years ago when a woman found videos of her on their website. She was a minor. After that, Pornhub had to take down 10 million sites because they all contained illegally purchased material or child pornography. Now, to give you a little sense of the issue, let's talk about the social ramifications of pornography. Pornography is not just sexual fantasies. It's not just seeing sexual imagery. The issue with pornography is how it affects the individual. Especially men, who are very visually driven, are affected by pornography as assuming that's how sex ought to be. Whatever images they see, they think that's the highest form of sexual encounter, and therefore they strive for it, even though most of those actors are truly acting, or actresses are acting as well. They don't feel the pleasure that we think they do. In the same way, the endorphin rush that's caused by pornography has been shown through many studies to rewire the brain to desire more pleasure and to have a harder time concentrating and being able to form proper relationships. The same way, high use of pornography affects the way men see relationships and makes it more challenging for them to enter into a deep, committed relationship. Pornography has many, many social ramifications. In a similar way, a man viewing pornography may have struggles in his relationship because his wife, spouse, or girlfriend doesn't understand what he's doing and therefore feels devalued or that she's not beautiful enough or that he doesn't love her. The social ramifications of pornography cannot be overstated. But it's not just pornography. The greater issue is the over-sexualization of media. It's hard to find a movie nowadays that doesn't have any sexual content. I have found one. And that was the latest Doctor Strange movie, The Multiverse of Madness. It had a few people who were a little less clothed, but nothing specifically sexual. Very weird for modern movies. It's almost impossible to find even books nowadays, children's books, that don't have some sort of sex related to it. Basically, my point is, children today are so inundated with sexual imagery and sexual concepts and themes that they can't escape it or find something good within it. They are wrestling with this concept at a time in which it's developing within them and they don't know what it's supposed to be like. The same way, they're thinking that's how relationships ought to be and they cannot enter good, true, solid relationships because they have no skills in it. And all they see is improper relationships. So we have to be very careful. We need to be advocating against these things and striving against them, working to root out sexually explicit material, pornography, and all these things that are degrading both children and adults. It's becoming so common nowadays that it's almost impossible not to find any kind of sex-related imagery. Okay, our last topic for sexual ethics, and the one that I want to spend as much time as I need explaining it, so that we understand where the church is and where it's not. This one is very misunderstood and can cause a lot of discrepancies or disappointments if not described well. That's homosexuality. I'm going to start with the church's perspective on this because the church has a perspective that most people have not heard. The Catechism of the Catholic Church has three paragraphs about homosexuality. In these three paragraphs, it describes the following. The first paragraph reminds us that all people are accorded the same human dignity. Regardless of sexual orientation, race, culture, class, or religion, all people have the same dignity. Because of this dignity, no person should be prejudiced or harassed based on racial, cultural, or sexual differences. The church is not here to harass people who have same-sex attraction. They're not here to condemn them. In the same way, the second paragraph goes on to explain a part of it that we don't often hear. People who are dealing with some same-sex attraction are supposed to be treated with compassion because their challenges are so great. We have to realize that they need our help, they need our compassion, they need our support to be able to deal well with these issues. The feelings that they have, the confusion they may have, the challenges they may face, all these are part of it. One of the things I really appreciate about the way the Catholic Church presents it is the Catholic Church does not present an origin. I gave a talk a while ago on the different origins of homosexuality, including genetic, behavioral, nurture-based, or some sort of epigenetic. I dislike all of them. I dislike all of them because regardless of what origin myth you decide, it's going to lead to a fix-it mentality. If it's genetic, we can just eliminate the genetic disorder. If it's emotional, psychotherapy. If it's epigenetic, deal with it with genetics. All those things treat people as though they are just machines, things we can fix. That's degrading. And so the church does not give an origin, and instead makes a point that we have to understand and love these people and the struggles they have as a way of helping them to feel fulfilled, feel good within it, and be able to become who they are. That being said, there are some sharp differences between what society views and what the church views. Society wants to make all sexual acts acceptable. And there seems to be no limit to it, even though we're starting to form boundaries around some of it. For instance, the National Association of Man-Boy Love is not well accepted as someone who wants to encourage the marrying age to be reduced down to 8. We have limits on what our marrying age should be. We also have limits on what is considered proper sexual actions. In the same way, the church states that homosexual actions, not people, actions, are considered immoral. And homosexual tendencies, same-sex attraction, is against natural law, but not immoral on its own. So even though someone may feel attracted to someone of the same sex, that does not make them an immoral person or a bad person. It's just who they are. How we act on those things and what we do with that changes the moral character. Choosing immoral actions makes them immoral. And therefore, sexual actions that are outside the context of marriage are immoral. Doesn't matter if they're homosexual or heterosexual. All sexual actions outside of marriage are immoral. So there's where the church is at. Homosexual people are people and should be treated with dignity and respect. Homosexual actions are immoral because they are sexual actions outside the context of marriage. What we need to do, we need to start dialogue on support and encouragement. We need to work towards reconciliation and finding places for people where they feel like they have none. And the judgmentalism and degradation of people that we so often fall into needs to stop, especially in the realms of sexuality. As I finish this section on sexuality, I want you to ponder these things. There is a great good that comes through sex. There's a great wonder about our sexual interactions and what it means for us as people. There's a great joy in the union of spouses for the procreation of children. We can work towards these goods. We can become better through it. And we can promote the good of our society by choosing a different route. We are well over-sexualized right now and so focused on sex as the end of all things, the epitome of all relationship. It is not. It is to some extent when they have a committed relationship. That's when sex reaches its greatest pinnacle and becomes the most efficacious in showing great love.